4. The Waylord was in the back gallery, talking with Desak. Desak was not a native of Anzul, but of Sundraman. He had been a soldier in their army. He never brought books, or talked of books. He stood very straight, spoke harshly, and seldom smiled. I thought he must have known much grief. He and the Waylord treated each other with respect and friendship. Their long conversations were always private. They both looked at me rather sternly, in silence, as I walked down the room to where they were sitting under the end window in a patch of sunlight. The back part of the house, the oldest part, all of stone and built right up against the hillside, is chilly, and we didn't have much firewood to warm the rooms. I greeted them. The Waylord raised his eyebrows, waiting for my message. "There are travelers here from the far north who need stabling for their horses. He is a storyteller, and she—" I paused. "She has a lion. A half-lion. I told her I would ask if they may keep their horses here." As I spoke, I felt like a person in a tale of the Lords of Manva, bearing a request from a noble visitor to a noble host. "Circus people," Desak said. "Nomads." Outraged at his contemptuous tone, I said, "No." The Waylord's eyebrows went down at my rudeness. "She is Gry of the Barris of Rodmont, of the Uplands," I said. "And where are these Uplands?" said Desak, speaking to me as to a child. "In the far north," I said. The Waylord said, "Memer, a little further, please." That was how he always asked me to go on translating a line of Aratan, or explaining anything. He liked me to do it in order, making sense. I tried. "Her husband came to tell stories in the harbor market, so they were there. Her lion frightened an Ald's horse. I caught the horse, then she quieted it. Then, when I was coming home, I met her with her wagon, and she brought me home. She was looking for stabling. The lion is in the wagon. Gudit is watering the horses." Only as I mentioned coming home did I realize that the market basket, with a 10-pound fish and cheese and greens in it, was still weighing down my arm. There was a pause. "You offered her use of the stables?" "I said I'd ask you." "Will you ask her to come to me?" "Yes," I said, and got away quickly. I left the basket in the pantry cooler. Ista and the others were all still sewing in the workroom, and ran back to the stable yard. Gry and Gudit were talking about dogs. That is, Gudit was telling her about the great follow-hounds of Galvamond in the old days that ran with the horses and guarded the gates. "Nowadays all it is cats. Cats everywhere," he said, spitting aside. "No meat for dogs any more, see? It stands to reason. It was meat they were themselves, those dogs, in the siege years."
"Maybe it's just as well you have no follow-hounds just now," she said. "They'd be anxious about the contents of our wagon."
I said, "The Waylord asks if you will be pleased to come into the house. He would come himself, but it's hard for him to walk far." I wanted so badly to welcome her rightly, nobly, generously, as the Lords of Manva welcomed strangers to their houses.
"With pleasure," she said.
"But first—"
"Leave the horses to me," said Gudit. "I'll put 'em both in the loose box, and then be off for a bit of hay from Bosty down the way there."
"There's a truss of hay and a barrel of oats in the wagon," Gry said, going to show him. But he brushed her off.
Nah. Nobody brings their own feed to the Waylord's house. Come along here then, old lady."
"She's Star," said Gry, "and he's Branty." At their names, both horses looked round at her, and the mare whoofed. "And it would be well if you knew what else is in the wagon," Gry said. And there was something in her voice, though she spoke low and mild, that made even Gudit turn and listen to her.
"A cat," she said. "Another cat. But a big one. She's trustworthy, but not to be taken by surprise.
Don't open the wagon door, please.
Memer, shall I leave her here in the wagon,
shall she come with me into the house? When you're lucky, press your luck. I wanted Desak to see the circus lion and be scared stiff. If you wish to bring her... She studied me a moment. Best leave her here, she said with a smile. And thinking of Ista and Sosta screaming and screeching at the sight of a lion passing by in the corridor, I knew she was right. She followed me through the courtyards around to the front entrance. On the threshold, she stopped and murmured the invocation of the guest to the house gods. "Are your gods the same as ours?" I asked. "The Uplands haven't much in the way of gods, but as a traveler I've learned to honor and ask blessing of any gods or spirits that will grant it." I liked that. "The Ald spit on our gods," I said. "Sailors say it's unwise to spit into the wind," she said. I had brought her the long way round, wanting her to see the reception hall and the great court and the wide hallways leading to the old university rooms and galleries and the inner courts. It was all bare, unfurnished, the statues broken, the tapestries stolen, the floors unswept. I was half proud for her to see it, and half bitterly ashamed. She walked through it with wide, keen eyes. There was a wariness in her. She was easy and open, but self-contained and on the alert, like a brave animal in a strange place. I knocked at the carved door of the back gallery, and the Waylord bade us enter. Desak had gone. The Waylord stood to greet the visitor. They bowed their heads formally as they spoke their names. "Be welcome to the house of my people," he said. And she, "My greeting to the house of Galva and its people, and my honor to the gods and ancestors of the house." When they looked up at each other, I saw his eyes full of curiosity and interest, and hers shining with excitement. "You've come a long way to bring your greeting," he said. "To meet Sultur Galva, the Waylord." His face closed, like a book shutting. "Ansul has no lords but the Alds," he said. "I am a person without importance." Gry glanced at me as if for support, but I had none to give. She said to him, "Your pardon if I spoke amiss, but may I tell you what brought us to Ansul? My husband, Oryk Caspro, and me." Now at that name he looked as utterly amazed as she had when I said his title to her. "Caspro is here?" he said. "Oryk Caspro?" He took a deep breath. He gathered himself and spoke in his stiffest, most formal tone. "The fame of the poet runs before him. He honors our city with his presence. Memer told me that a maker is to speak in the marketplace, but I did not know who it was." "He will recite for the Gond of the Alds, too," said Gry. "The Gond sent for my husband, but that's not why we came to Ansul." The pause was a heavy one. "We sought this house," Gry said. "And to this house your daughter brought me, though I didn't know she was its daughter, and she didn't know I sought it." He looked at me. "Truth," I said, and because he still looked at me, distrustful, I said, "The gods have been with me all day. It is a day of Lero." That carried weight with him. He rubbed his upper lip with the first knuckle of his left hand, the way he does when he's thinking hard. Then suddenly he came to a decision, and the distrust was gone.
"As you are brought in Lero's hands, the blessing of the house is yours," he said, "and all in it is yours. Will you sit down, Grybarra?"
I saw that she watched the way he moved as he showed her to the clawfoot chair, that she saw his crippled hands as he lowered himself into the armchair. I perched on the high stool by the table. "As Caspro's fame has come to you," she said, "so the fame of the libraries of Ansul has come to us."
"And your husband came here to see those libraries?"
"He seeks the nourishment of his art and his soul in books," she said.
At that I wanted to give all my heart to her, to him.
"He must know,"
the Waylord said without emotion,
"that the books of Ansul were destroyed, with many of those who read them. No libraries are permitted in the city. The written word is forbidden. The word is the breath of Ath, the only god, and only by the breath may it be spoken. To entrap it in writing is blasphemy, abominable."
I flinched, hating to hear him speak those words. He sounded as if he believed them, as if they were his own words. Gry was silent. He said,
"I hope Auric Caspero brought no books with him."
"No," she said. "He came to seek them."
"As well seek bonfires in the sea," he said.
She came right back. "Or milk a desert stone." I saw the flicker in his eyes, that almost hidden glint, when she answered with the rest of Denios's line. "May he come here?" she asked, quite humbly. I wanted to shout, "Yes, yes!" I was shocked, ashamed, when the Waylord did not at once answer, inviting him warmly to come, to be welcome. He hesitated, and then all he said was,
"He is the guest of the Gond Iroth?"
"A message came to us when we were in Urdale, saying that Iroth, the Gond of the Alds of Ansul, would make welcome Auric Caspero, the Gond of all makers, if he would come and display his art. We are told that the Gond Iroth is very fond of hearing tales and poems, as are his people. So we came, but not as his guests. He offered stabling for our horses, but not for us. His god would be offended if unbelievers came under his roof. When Auric goes to perform for the Gond, it will be outdoors, under the open sky."
The Waylord said something in Aratan. I wasn't sure, but I thought it was about the sky having room enough for all the stars and gods. He looked at her to see if she understood the line. She cocked her head.
"I am an ignorant woman," she said in her mild way.
He laughed.
"Hardly."
"No, truly. My husband has taught me a little, but my own knowledge is not in words at all. My gift is to listen to those who don't talk."
"You walk with a lion," Mimir said.
"I do. We travel a lot, and travelers are vulnerable. After our good dog died, I looked for another guardian companion. We met with a company of nomads, tellers, and musicians, who trapped a half-lion and her cub in the desert hills south of Valdalva. They kept the mother for their shows, but sold us the cub. She's a good companion, and trustworthy."
"What is her name?"
I asked very softly.
"Shitar." "Where is she now?"
the Waylord asked. "In our wagon, in your stable yard."
"I hope to see her. As I too am unburdened with belief, I am free to offer you the shelter of my roof, Grybarra. You and your husband, your horses, and your lion."
She thanked him for his generosity, and he said,
"The poor are rich in generosity."
Ever since she had spoken her husband's name, his face had been alight.
"Mimir,"
he said.
"Which room?"
I'd already decided that, and was calculating whether the fish could feed 8 if Ista made a stew with it. "The east room," I said.
"How about the master's room?"
That startled me a little, for I knew his mother had lived in that beautiful, spacious apartment, upstairs from his rooms in this oldest part of the house. Long ago, when Galvamond housed the university and library of Ansul, that apartment had belonged to its head, the master. Its unbroken, small-paned windows looked over the lower roofs of the house westward to Sul. There was a bedstead in it, and nothing much else now. But I could bring a mattress from the east room, and the chair from mine.
"I'll lay a fire there," I said,
for I knew the unused room would be dank and cold. The Waylord looked at me with great kindness. He said to Grybarra,
"Mimir is my hands, and half my head. She is not the daughter of my body, but of my house and heart. Her gods and ancestors are mine.
I knew well that I was of the blood of Galva, but it gave me a painful joy to hear him say what he said.
In the market, Gry said, a horse bolted when it saw my cat. It threw its rider and ran straight at Memer.
She caught the reins and stopped and held it.
I'll go get the room ready, I said, finding praise hard to bear.
Gry excused herself and came with me, wanting to help me with the room. Once we had made up the bed and got a fire going in the hearth, it was done, and she said she'd go bring her husband here from the harbor market. I longed to hear him, and she saw that. He'll be nearly done speaking, I think, she said, but I'd be glad of your company.
I'll leave Shatar in the wagon. She's fine there.
As we went out, she added,
one lion is enough.
How could I not love her?
So Grybera and I went afoot back down to the harbor market.
There I first heard the maker Auric Caspero speak. The tent was full, and the front and sides had been raised for people to stand outside it, crowded together like trees on a mountainside, all still, listening. He was telling the tale of the fire-tailed bird from Denios's transformations. I knew it, and older people of Ansul there knew it. But to the old soldiers, and there were many, all in the best places, up close to the platform in the tent, and to most of the young people, it was new, a wonder. All stood with moving lips and gazing eyes, rapt in the story poem. Caught in it, too, hearing the teller's even resonant voice and clear northern accent, I hardly saw him himself. I listened and saw the story happen. When he was done, the great crowd stood in silence for a long breath's space, and then said, ah. And then they began to applaud him, the Alds by hitting their palms together loudly, and we by crying the old praise word, eho, eho. I saw him then, a handsome, thin, straight, dark man, with a certain defiance in his stance up there on the dais, though he was most gracious with the crowd. We could not get near him for a long time. I should have brought the other lion, too, Gry said, as we tried in vain to pry through the massed backs of the soldiers and officers with their blue cloaks and their sheep hair and their swords and crossbows and bludgeons, all pressing round the speaker, who had come down among them. When he leapt back up on the platform and scanned the crowd, Gry made her bird's whistle, loud and piercing this time. At once he saw her. She nodded to our left, and a few minutes later he met us by the steps of the customs. Now that the soldiers had dispersed, many citizens trailed him, but they were timid, unwilling to press forward. Only one elderly man came up to him and bowed as we bow in thanks to our gods, deeply, with open hands that hold the gift given and received.
Praise to the Maker, he whispered.
He straightened up and walked swiftly away. He was in tears. He was a man who had brought books to the Wailord more than once. I didn't know his name. Auric Caspero saw us and strode forward. He took both Gry's hands for a moment.
Get me out, he said. Where's Shatar?
At Galvamont, she said, pronouncing the name northernwise. I am with Dekalo's daughter, Mamere of Galvamont. We're to be guests of that house. His eyes widened. He greeted me courteously and asked no questions, but he looked as if he had some. Please excuse me, I said on the spur of the moment. I forgot something at the market this morning. You know the way. I'll catch up. And I left them. It was true that Ista would need more greens for a stew for eight. I always wondered why the makers leave housekeeping and cooking out of their tales. Isn't it what all the great wars and battles are fought for? So that at day's end a family may eat together in a peaceful house? The tale tells how the lords of Manva hunted and gathered roots and cooked their suppers while they were camped in exile in the foothills of Sul. But it doesn't say what their wives and children were living on,
and their city left ruined and desolate by the enemy. They were finding food, too, somehow, cleaning house and honoring the gods, the way we did in the siege, and under the tyranny of the Alds. When the heroes came back from the mountain, they were welcomed with a feast. I'd like to know what the food was, and how the women managed it. I saw Gry and her husband at the top of West Street when I started up the hill from Gelb Bridge. When I came into the kitchen, Sosta and Bomi were all agog, having met the guests, and Ista was on the very edge of a tantrum. "How in the name of Sumpa the Destroyer is a woman to feed guests on a scrap of fish and a kale stock?" The additional greens and celery root I brought averted disaster. She set to work grating ginger and chopping thesany and ordering Bomi and even Sosta about unmercifully. Galvamond would not scant its guests or shame its ancestors if Ista could help it. This is part of what I meant about housework. If it isn't important, what is? If it isn't done honorably, where is honor? Ista could tell us about the banquets for 40 in the great dining hall in the old days, but we always ate in what she called the pantry, a large room full of shelves and counters between the dining hall and the kitchens. Gudit had built a table of pine scraps, and we had found a chair here and a chair there. The Waylord's longest walk in a day was often from his room, through the corridors, past the staircases and the inner courtyards, to dinner in the pantry. Tonight he came wearing the heavy, stiff gray robe that was the only fine clothing he had left from the good days. All of us had cleaned up a bit, except Gudit, who smelled very much of horse. Gry wore a long red shirt over narrow silk pants, and her husband, a white shirt, black coat, and black kilt that left his legs bare below the knee. He was very good-looking in his black, and Sosta goggled at him like the fish on its slab in the market. But the Waylord was a handsome man, too, for all his lameness, and when he greeted Auric Caspero, I thought again of the heroes Adira and Mara. Both he and Caspero stood very straight, though it must have cost the Waylord more to do so. We sat to table, Gry at the Waylord's right hand and Caspero at his left, Sosta next to Bomi down the table, Gudit next to me, and the place at the foot empty, because Ista would never sit with us till late in the meal. "A cook at the table, a burnt dinner," she said, which may have been true, when there were more people to be served and more dinner to burn. She stood while my lord gave the man's blessing, and I the woman's, and then she vanished while we ate her excellent bread and fish stew. I was glad for the honor of our house that the food was so good. "You of Ansul do as we do in the uplands," Caspero said. His voice was the most beautiful thing about him. It was like a viol. "The household eats at one table. It makes me feel at home."
"Tell us something of the uplands," the Waylord said.
Caspero looked about at us, smiling, not knowing where to begin. "Do you know anything of the place at all?" "It's far to the north," I said, as no one else spoke. "A hilly land, with a great mountain." And the name came to me then, as if I was seeing Erant's map. "The Carantages? And the people are said to practice wizardry, but that's only what Erant says." Bomi and Sosta stared, the way they always did when I knew anything they didn't. I thought it very stupid, as if I should stare every time they talked about how to hem a gusset or gusset a hem, whichever it is. I didn't always understand them, but I didn't stare at them as if they were crazy for knowing what they knew. Caspero said to me, "The Carantages is our great mountain, as Sewell is yours. The uplands are all hill and stone, and the farmers poor. Some of them have powers, indeed, but wizardry is a dangerous word. We call them gifts. Among the Alds we called them nothing at all," said Gry in her dry, slightly teasing way, not wishing to be stoned to death for the sin of coming from a gifted people.
"What?"
Bomi began, and then stuck. For once she was shy.
Gry encouraged her, and Bomi asked,
"Do you have a gift?"
"I get along with animals, and they with me. The gift is called calling, but it's more like hearing, actually." "I have no gift," Caspero said with a smile.
"I cannot believe you so ungrateful,"
the Waylord said, not joking. Caspero accepted the reproof. "You're right, Waylord. I was indeed given a great gift. But it was the wrong one." He frowned and sought almost desperately for words, as if it were the most important thing in the world that he should answer honestly. "Not wrong for me, but for my people. So it took me from them, from the uplands. I have great joy in my art, but there are times I'm sick at heart, missing the rocks and bogs and the silence of the hills." The Waylord looked at him patiently, unjudging, approving.
"One can be sick for home in one's own city, in one's own house, Auric Caspero. You are an exile among exiles here."
He raised his glass. There was water in it. We had no wine.
"To our homecoming," he said.
And we all drank with him.
"If your gift is the wrong one, what would the right one have been?"
asked Bomi, whose shyness once gone is gone forever. Caspero looked at her. His face changed again. He might have given a light answer to her light question, and she'd have been satisfied. But that wasn't in him to do.
"My family's gift is the unmaking," he said,
and involuntarily put both hands over his eyes for a moment. A strange moment.
"But I was given the gift of making. By mistake."
He looked up as if bewildered. I saw Gry watching him across the table, intent, concerned.
"No mistake about it,"
said the Waylord, with a calm, genial authority that lightened the uncanny mood.
"And all you were given, you give to us in your poetry. I wish I could come hear you."
"Don't encourage him," Gry said. "He'll spout you poems till the cows come home."
Sosta giggled. I think it was the first thing anybody said she understood. And she thought it was funny to say, "till the cows come home." Caspero laughed too, and told us that he could speak poetry forever. "The only thing I like better than saying is hearing," he said, "or reading." In his glance at the Waylord, there was a signal, or challenge, heavier than the words themselves. But then, reading was a heavy word in our city under the Alds.
"This was a good house for poetry, once," my lord said. "Will you have a little more fish, Grybearer?"
"Ista, are you coming or not, woman?"
Ista likes it when he raises his voice, when he orders her to sit and eat. She bustled in at once, bobbed to the guests, and as soon as she had blessed her bread, asked,
"What's Gudit going on about a lion?"
"It's in the wagon,"
Gudit said.
"I told you, you godless fool, don't go meddle with that wagon," I said. "You didn't, did you?"
"Of course I did nothing of the sort."
Offended by Gudit's coarseness and his loud voice, Ista became ladylike, almost mincing.
"A lion is nothing to me. Will it be staying in the wagon, then?"
"She'll be best staying with us, if it won't disturb the household," Gry said. But seeing the sensation this caused in Sosta and Bomi, and possibly Ista, she added quickly,
"But maybe it's better she sleeps in the wagon."
"That sounds cramped. May we meet our other guest?"
said the Waylord. I had never seen him like this, genial, forceful. I was seeing Ista's Waylord of the good days.
"Has she had her dinner? Please bring her in."
"Oh,"
Sosta said faintly.
"'Twon't be you she eats, Sos,'
Easter said.
"'More likely she'd fancy a bit of fish.'
She was not going to be overawed by any lion.
"'I kept out the head, just for broth, you know. She's more than welcome to it.'
"'I thank you, Easter, but she ate early this morning,' Gry said. "'And tomorrow's her fasting day. A fat lion is a terrible thing to see.'
"'I have no doubt,' said Easter primly.
Gry excused herself and presently came in with her half-lion, led on a short leash. The animal was the size of a large dog, but very different in shape and gait. A cat, long-bodied, yet compact, lithe, smooth, long-tailed, with the short face and forward-looking jewel eyes of a cat, and a pace between slouching and majestic. She was sand-colored, tawny. The hairs round her face were lighter, long and fine, and the short fur around the mouth and under the chin was white. The long tail ended in a little tawny plume. I was half scared, half enchanted. The half-lion sat down on her haunches, looked all around at us, opened her mouth to show a broad pink tongue and fearsome white teeth in a yawn, closed her mouth, closed her great topaz eyes, and purred. It was a loud, rumbling, deliberate purr.
"Oh," Bomi said. "Can I pet her?"
And I followed Bomi. The lion's fur was lovely, deep and thick. When you scratched around her round, neat ears, she leaned into your hand, and the purr deepened. Gry led her to the Wailord. Chitara sat down beside his chair, and he put his hand out for her to sniff. She sniffed it thoroughly, and then looked up at him. Not with the long dog gaze. One keen cat glance. He put his hand on her head. She sat there with half-shut eyes, purring, and I saw the big talons of her forepaws working in and out gently against the slate floor.